Good day. Today is Wednesday, 26th November 2025, and as you can see, I am back in London. And may I first of all take this opportunity to thank you all for bearing with me whilst I was away in Edinburgh. I should add that as well as being a holiday, I had some very fruitful meetings with, one particular person who resides in Edinburgh and with whom I exchanged thoughts and ideas, mostly about the situation in Britain. But about that, I will say more at a later time. Anyway, obviously, broadcasting from Edinburgh, the conditions were less than ideal, and for any problems that caused, please accept my sincere apologies and my thanks to all of you for bearing with me during that time. The second thing I'm now going to say briefly, as I now regularly do, is that once you've listened to this programme, if you've liked the programme, or whichever part of the programme you've listened to or choose to listen to and have liked, if you've liked it, well, please indicate the fact by pressing the like button. Now, without more ado, let's talk about what is an incredibly confusing diplomatic situation and a very clear and increasingly stark military situation in the conflict in Ukraine. And to repeat again what I have said in programme after programme, stretching back a long time now, certainly to 2022, it is the military situation which is driving the political and the diplomatic situation. But let's start with the diplomacy, because this is what has been attracting all the news and all the attention and all the commentary. It's actually very strange reading the Western media, because they are entirely focused on the diplomacy, on who said what to whom, what the various plans will say in all of this. And they pay almost no attention to what is actually going on the ground in Ukraine at all. It's all as if all of the diplomacy is taking place entirely in the abstract. And of course, without a discussion, without a serious recognition of the true facts, which straightforwardly are that Ukraine is losing and losing badly, and that it is now at risk, serious risk, of a total military collapse. Unless one grasps that fact, which is obvious to anybody who has been following attentively the situation on the ground, then of course the diplomacy makes no sense. And I get to suggest that it is precisely for that reason that the media in the West, which is almost unanimous in its hostility to these diplomatic initiatives we see coming out of Washington, it is for that reason that they don't want to discuss the situation on the front lines. Now, before I proceed, let me quickly say that this is completely and profoundly illogical. In fact, it makes absolutely no sense at all. It is as if the media in the West, European governments, and by the way, the government of Ukraine and the various hardliners in Washington want Ukraine to lose totally and completely, to be in effect destroyed, because that is the logical end consequence, end result of what they seem to be trying to do, which is to obstruct all diplomatic initiatives to end the conflict in any shape or form. Now, a couple of days ago, the Europeans, the Ukrainians, and the Americans met in Geneva. And the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, gave very, very positive spin about that meeting. He suggested that huge progress had been made, that all sorts of things had been agreed about the plan, that the Ukrainians were mostly in agreement with the key provisions of the plan, and that the process of negotiations with the Russians was proceeding well, and the Ukrainians were fully on side. Now, the more information we're getting, the more clear it is becoming that this is completely wrong. In fact, this spin that Rubio has been engaging in, to my mind, calls very much into question his own role in this entire enterprise. And as we shall see shortly, one of the major problems with this enterprise to achieve some kind of peace is that it has not got the unanimous support of the administration, everybody in the administration in Washington, let alone the political class and the permanent bureaucracy of the United States. But anyway, we now learn from CNN that over the course of the meetings in Geneva, the Ukrainians made it absolutely clear that they are not prepared to concentrate, to compromise on certain essential points. Firstly, they are not prepared to make changes to their constitution, which commits Ukraine to joining NATO. So Ukraine continues to insist that it must ultimately and eventually join NATO. And that, by the way, remains also the European position. Two, secondly, the Ukrainians are not prepared to compromise in any essential respect about the size of their armed forces. Now, this has been a hot topic. Back in April 2022, the Russians, during the negotiations in Istanbul, suggested that Ukraine reduce the total size of its armed forces to 85,000 men. The Ukrainians argued for a higher number, 250,000 men, which would have been the same size as the regular Ukrainian forces at the start of the special military operation. Though at that time, Ukraine also had around 900,000 reservists who were, of course, called up and who provided Ukraine with the million-man army that it had by the summer of 2022. Anyway, there was no final agreement on this issue. There were still apparently negotiations to be made to sort it out. But anyway, in April 2022, that was the position. The Ukrainians were asking for an army of 250,000 men. The Russians wanted Ukraine to have an army of 85,000 men. But the Ukrainians were agreeing to a cap of on the size of their armed forces, at least in the draft agreement, which was initialed, but which was, of course, never ratified. Now, the Europeans, or at least someone, is insisting that Ukraine has armed forces numbering 800,000 men, which is 600,000 more men that, which is, sorry, more than the 600,000 men that the Americans had conceded in their own 28-point draft. That is a ridiculous figure. Ukraine does not have the resources to sustain an army of that size. It would require permanent funding from Europe and the United States for Ukraine to maintain armed forces on that scale. But in any event, it is multiples greater, 10 times greater than what the Russians were prepared to agree to in Istanbul. And it is almost certainly significantly more, I believe, multiples more than the actual fighting force that Ukraine has on the front lines at the present time. Now, my guess is that the total number of the Ukrainian armed forces, the fighting part of the Ukrainian armed forces currently, is around 200,000 men, maybe slightly less. There was a report recently that the Ukrainians are able to replace losses each month. They're able to recruit or re-enlist men at the rate of 17,000 a month, but that they're losing around 30,000 men a month, so that the Ukrainian army is shrinking by 10 to 15,000 men a month. Now, that is extraordinarily high, and I don't know whether that is true, but Ukrainian sources are apparently saying this, and I've no reason myself to look behind that. What I would say is that I have started to notice that Ukrainian military formations that I'd heard about before, like the 47th Mechanized Brigade, Ukraine's fire brigade force throughout the fighting in 2024, appear to have vanished from the battle map. The last I remember hearing about the 47th Mechanized Brigade was in the early summer, when elements from it were rushed to hold back the Russians in Sumy region. Since then, well, it has to all intents and purposes disappeared from view. The Russians recently said that Ukraine is currently losing roughly a brigade size force every week. And that would, from what I can see, square with the claim that Ukraine is losing around 30,000 men a month. Having said that, let me repeat again, I am not able to confirm this. It may be that this is wrong. I don't have that information to hand, though I do believe I know what the size of Ukraine's losses were up to the 1st of August. I've said this before, but I'm not prepared to provide information about it. Anyway, let's put that aside. The point is that the Ukrainians are resisting all attempts to reduce the size of their armed forces. And they have also apparently told the Americans, and they said this in Geneva, that they are not prepared to recognize or acknowledge any territorial concessions to the Russians whatsoever. They're not prepared to accept the Russian control of Donbass or of Crimea or of any territory. It is not clear at the moment whether the Ukrainians are prepared to withdraw their forces from Donbass, but my sense is that as of now they are not, and that the Europeans are backing them in this position. Now, clearly, changes to other provisions were of the 28-point plan were made in Geneva, and all of the indications are that these changes favoured Ukraine over Russia. But overall, it doesn't seem as if, despite claims from the White House and from President Trump himself, the tremendous progress has been made, that everything has been agreed, except for a few minor delicate details, as I think the White House spokesman said. It doesn't seem to me as if that is really true. Even as concerns the dialogue between the Americans and the Ukrainians. But let's now turn to what the Russians, who are, after all, the party that has to agree to these proposals if there is going to be peace, what the Russians are saying. Now, 2 days ago, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, gave a press conference. This was in connection with a meeting he had in Minsk. And I would add that the Belarusian Foreign Minister also attended this press conference. But it was what Lavrov said about the various diplomatic initiatives that were floating around, that this is what Lavrov said. And it was in reply to this question: did you discuss Trump's peace plan at the talks in Belarus? How can Belarus contribute to a settlement, including with due regard for Belarusian interests? Was the possibility of the synchronous lifting of sanctions from Russia and Belarus discussed at the talks? Do you think a new Minsk process is possible? And if so, who could take part in it? And this is Lavrov's rather crushing reply. Regarding the Ukraine crisis, we discussed it, of course, in particular in an informal setting yesterday. President Putin provided an explicit and clear comment on President Trump's peace plan at a meeting with permanent members of Russia's Security Council several days ago. Our assessment has not changed, because the key provisions of Trump's plan, and I think we can now definitely say that what is being referred to here is the 28-point plan that has been circulating. Though, to be clear again, it's possible that the version of this plan that the Russians have is not identical to the version that Goncharenko published a few days ago. Anyway, our assessment has not changed, because the key provisions of Trump's plan are based on the understandings reached at the Russia-US summit in Anchorage in August 2025. Overall, these principles have been reflected in this peace plan, which we welcomed. President Putin has pointed this out. After Anchorage, where our understandings were noted, as we thought, there was a long pause until the new document was presented. We have the text, but we have received it through unofficial channels. Now, that is a very interesting comment. Again, the Russians are reiterating that they have not been provided with the 28-point plan formally by the United States government. Somebody has provided them with a copy of this plan. I thought and said in a program that it might be that the Russians were taking this plan from Goncharenko, from the picture that Goncharenko provided. But I now think that somebody, perhaps Witkoff and Kushner, who are the authors, the main authors of this plan, perhaps they provided it to Dmitriev, who is, of course, not an official of the Russian government, and of Dmitriev then passed it on to Moscow, which would be consistent with what Lavrov is saying here, that we have received it through unofficial channels. And then Lavrov continues, it has not been officially sent to us. However, we are ready to discuss concrete details, as President Putin said. Quite a few issues in that document require clarification. And of course, if we're talking about the Goncharenko plan, as a Goncharenko version of the 28-point plan, that is an understatement. There are lots of ambiguities about the Goncharenko version of the 28-point plan, in particular the provision about there being no NATO troops allowed in Ukraine. As I have pointed out already, does in theory permit European troops to go to Ukraine outside the NATO structures, and that is something that the Russians would not agree to. And the various proposals about how to manage Russia's frozen assets, which I'm not going to discuss in this program, those are almost certainly unacceptable to the Russians also. But anyway, what the Russians are saying, that there are things in this plan which would work. There's the agreement that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass. There is the agreement that Donbass and Crimea and presumably other territories are accepted de facto as Russian, whatever that means. There are the provisions also about, the fact that NATO troops would not be stationed in Ukraine. Anyway, all of these issues can be discussed, but of course there are many issues to discuss as well. And then Lavrov continues, our American colleagues have not yet sent us the version of the text which the media are writing about. Now that is the version that has come out of the Geneva meeting, which apparently has been reduced to 19 points. Now, Ushakov, Putin's key foreign policy advisor, who is clearly now functioning as Putin's national security advisor, I'll discuss all that in another program. Anyway, he said this morning, as of this morning, that the Russians have still not seen the 19-point plan that came out of Geneva. And then Lavrov said, the goals of those who are practicing megaphone diplomacy are far from noble. In other words, all of the people who are commenting about the 19-point plan in the West, the media there, European governments, people who are spinning what is in this plan, they're clearly trying to sabotage the entire peace process. And then Lavrov continued, President Macron said the other day that Trump's plan is unacceptable because it means surrender to Russia. Others have said that everything must depend on Ukraine's willingness or unwillingness to agree to this or that. But serious diplomats discuss such issues confidentially until a final agreement is reached, as diplomats should do. The document has been deliberately leaked to make a fuss in the media environment. Those who are orchestrating this fuss make no secret of their desire to undermine peace efforts and would like to change Trump's plan to their liking. We have communication channels with our American colleagues. We are using them. We are waiting for the version of the plan they regard as provisional in terms of its final coordination with the Europeans and the Ukrainians. Then we will see if nothing is left of the letter and spirit of Anchorage in the key understandings, it will be a completely different situation. But so far, we have not received the official version. So what Lavrov is saying here is that we came to an understanding, the Russians came to an understanding with Trump and Witkoff in Anchorage. That understanding was essentially Istanbul plus, though the Russians appear to have agreed to a ceasefire, a transitional ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions until these two territories are in some form transferred to them in full. If Trump's plan builds on that as the original 28-point plan, which the Russians have received, which, to repeat again, might not be identical to the Goncharenko draft, if this 28-point plan builds on that agreement, that understanding in Anchorage, which the Americans and the Russians reached as the original version of the 28-point plan, draft plan, appears to do, then it's a step forward and the Russians will discuss it, and it may be that eventually it will lead to a peace settlement. But if it deviates from what the Americans and the Russians agreed in Anchorage, then it is a non-starter. If nothing is left of the letter and spirit of Anchorage in the key understandings, it will be a completely different situation. In other words, the plan will be rejected by Moscow. Now, that is absolutely clear, and it has been clearly set out and stated now by the Russians. Now, we've had further developments because, again, this continues to be an incredibly complex situation, to put it mildly. But we've had news that one key American official has now had talks with the Russians. And this comes from, and this official, this key official, was Trump's new peace envoy, who, Dan Driscoll, who gatecrashed a meeting in Abu Dhabi between Kirill Budanov, the Ukrainian chief of Ukraine's military intelligence, and some key intelligence officials from the Russian side. Now, again, the Americans leaked the fact that this meeting in Abu Dhabi was taking place, and that was an extraordinary thing to do, by the way, and we will see that it might have been a very dangerous thing to do by whoever was responsible for leaking that information. Very dangerous in that it could endanger someone's life, just saying. But anyway, we had the meeting between Driscoll and the Russians in Abu Dhabi, and we also had yesterday comments starting to circulate, reports starting to circulate, I believe in Axios, that the meeting between Driscoll and the Russians in Abu Dhabi went well. Now, just to say here, Driscoll is apparently still Assistant Secretary for War. He remains a Pentagon official. He apparently has a long-standing connection to the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, who is also playing a significant role in trying to promote this negotiation process. It seems that Driscoll and Vance have known each other for many years and first got to know each other in university. And Driscoll has now apparently replaced Kellogg as Trump's peace envoy. And Driscoll seems to me, for the moment, to be trying hard and to be doing many of the right things. Firstly, he said to the Europeans in Kiev a few days ago that Ukraine is losing the war, that Ukraine is going to be defeated, that there is nothing that can be done to change that fact. He told them the truth, in other words, the necessary truth, as I discussed at the start of this program. The Europeans were furious, and there was a comment from one of the European participants, I presume a British participant, of this meeting in Kiev, He told the Financial Times that the meeting was repugnant. It's incredible that the Europeans continue to close their eyes and close their ears to the bad news that is continuing to come from the battlefronts. But Driscoll had the courage to do that, and Driscoll pointed out that this plan that is being proposed now, the original 28-point plan, based on the Anchorage agreements, this could very well turn out to be Ukraine's last chance. Anyway, so Driscoll did that. Driscoll has now done something else, which is that he's talked to the Russians. General Kellogg was appointed Donald Trump's peace envoy. I knew very little about Kellogg when he was first appointed peace envoy, but it did seem to me, and I said so at the time, this is back in January, that at least Trump was appointing a peace envoy, which is more than Joe Biden ever did. Except it turned out that Kellogg was in no sense, or at least didn't see himself as any kind of peace envoy. Because I expected that as peace envoy, Trump's peace envoy, the first or almost the first thing that Kellogg would do would be to establish some kind of dialogue with the Russians. Except he never did. He never spoke to the Russians. He visited Kiev. In fact, he visited Kiev many times. He spoke often to Zelensky and Yermak and whoever it was who was Ukraine's foreign minister, and to the military officials in Kiev as well. He became very quickly the lobbyist and spokesman of the Ukrainian point of view in Washington, D.C., but he never showed, as far as I could see, any interest in talking to the Russians at all. How that squares with him being a peace envoy, I could never understand. And very quickly, Trump seems to realise this fact, which is why he appointed Steve Witkoff to conduct the dialogue with the Russians, which meant that for a time, the United States simultaneously had two peace envoys, Kellogg and Witkoff, obviously working at cross purposes with each other. Anyway, Driscoll, who has taken Kellogg's place, is doing that thing which Kellogg was not prepared to do. He has decided to speak to the Russians. And he appears to have learnt about a secret meeting between the Ukrainian military intelligence chief, Kirill Budanov, and the Russian military intelligence, which took place in Abu Dhabi. And he seems to have decided that he would gatecrash it as an opportunity to establish some kind of private back channel to the Russians. Now, I should say that in itself, this is absolutely not wrong. In fact, it is the absolutely correct thing to do. And I don't here criticise at all what Driscoll did, though the consequences of what happened after could very well proved to be disastrous. Anyway, let's now turn to what the Russians are saying happened. And we've had this from no less a person than Ushakov, Putin's national security advisor himself. Ushakov has now spoken to the Russian media. And this is what Ushakov said. As you know, everyone is currently either in Abu Dhabi or Dubai. And amongst this crowd were representatives who were conducting serious work. They are representatives of the special services of Ukraine and Russia. They periodically meet and discuss very delicate issues, including those concerning prisoner exchanges. So Ushakov is confirming that there has been a secret back channel between Ukrainian military intelligence and presumably Russian military intelligence, and that this back channel is located in the UAE and that it has been underway for some time. And he says that the officials, the intelligence officials from the two countries, which are, of course, fighting a war with each other, meet privately in the UAE and discuss various things, various delicate and difficult but important things, including, of course, prisoner exchanges. And I'm going to suggest that, in fact, it is not just prisoner exchanges that these people talk about and discuss. I am sure that they discuss many other things as well. The course of the war, the political situation in their respective countries. There's probably a significant exchange of information taking place. And just to say that we know that the person who is heading the Ukrainian side of this back channel is Kirill Budanov, Ukraine's head of military intelligence. So, to continue with what Ushakov said, during the meeting, there was also a piano in the bushes. This is a new US representative who is now dealing with the Ukrainian dossier. Obviously, he means Driscoll. He also appeared there and had a meeting, as I understand, with Ukrainian representatives. And in fact, the American media has confirmed that Driscoll came to Abu Dhabi and gatecrashed the meeting and had a meeting with Budanov, the Ukrainian military intelligence chief, who was there in Abu Dhabi in order to conduct the back channel. And then Ushakov continues, probably this was agreed upon in advance. In other words, that Budanov and Driscoll had agreed with each other to meet in Abu Dhabi. And then Ushakov continues, and he also unexpectedly met with our representatives. This is what happened in the great city of Abu Dhabi. On our side, it was not Naryshkin. Naryshkin is the head of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, and he is a member of the Russian Security Council. So he's a very senior person, and he's a top political figure in Russia, who was for a time, as I remember, the Speaker of Russia's Parliament, the Duma. He said, on our side, it was not Naryshkin, but representatives of the relevant services of a lower level who deal with practical issues, very complex, delicate, and so on. Now, I'm guessing, and this is purely my own guess, but I'm guessing that the Russian official, the senior Russian official present in Abu Dhabi, who was meeting Budanov and then who met with Driscoll, was Admiral Igor Kostyakov, who is the head of Russian military intelligence, of the organization, by the way, that people in the West still refer to by its old Soviet name, the GRU. Now, Kostyakov is obviously a very senior intelligence officer, but he is a military officer. He does not have any political background. He is not a member of Russia's Security Council. He does not report directly to Putin. He reports to Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff. So when Ushakov says that this would be a lower level official, someone who is not competent to discuss political matters, that would fit Kostyakov quite well. And then Ushakov continues, the peace plan was not discussed in Abu Dhabi. The peace plan has not yet been discussed in detail with anyone. We have seen it. It was handed over to us, but there have been no discussions yet. There is no official document, but there is an unofficial one. We have not discussed it with anyone yet because it requires really serious analysis, serious discussion. Some points can be viewed positively, but many require special discussion amongst experts. So what Ushakov is clearly referring to here is the original 28-point plan that was provided to the Russians, as both Putin and Lavrov have said through unofficial channels. Reading these words from Ushakov, it's clear that the Russians have not been provided with the updated 19-point version of the plan that came out of the Geneva meeting. And whatever, maybe Driscoll came to discuss the peace plan with Kostyakov. I'm assuming it was Kostyakov in Abu Dhabi, but Kostyakov explained to Driscoll that as he is not a politician or a diplomat or a member of Russia's Security Council, as he was in Abu Dhabi, present in Abu Dhabi to discuss other matters, he was not in a position himself to discuss or comment on the peace plan. And then Ushakov continues, the situation is being quickly sorted out because not only we are, so to speak, participants in this process, although it is clear why we are, but also France and the Europeans are getting involved in all of these matters. Completely unnecessary, as it seems to me. Discussions, I emphasise once again, serious discussions between teams of the two countries, he means Russia and the United States, have not yet taken place. But contacts are ongoing, including by phone. No one has yet sat at the round table and discussed this, that, or at another point, and so on. This has not happened. So what Ushakov is saying is that Driscoll turned up in Abu Dhabi. He met with the Russian representatives there. The Russians were not expecting to see him. They were very surprised that he had come. Everything suggests that the meeting was cordial and friendly, but the Russians did explain to Driscoll that they were not really in a position to discuss or comment about the peace plan, and that if Driscoll really wanted to discuss the peace plan with anyone in Moscow, then he would need to discuss it with somebody more senior at a higher level. And in fact, over the last few hours, we have heard that a decision has now been made to send Witkoff and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who is now also apparently participating in this process, and I'm guessing Driscoll as well, to Moscow to meet with the Russians. Now, Putin, as it happens, has an exceptionally tight schedule in December. He is currently in Kyrgyzstan, where he's having meetings with the Kyrgyz leadership, but he's also meeting with the chief heads of state and government of Russia's military alliance, the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Then very soon, on the 3rd of December, by all reports. He's heading to India, where he's going to have a very high-level meeting and summit meeting with Prime Minister Modi of India and his officials. And apparently there's a very big Russian delegation coming with Putin to India. And then there's going to be a very high-level meeting indeed, with all sorts of important agreements and packages discussed and probably signed over the course of that meeting. And then later in December, Putin is also going to be providing one of his great television news marathons, in which he fields questions. I'm not sure whether it'll be from the Russian media or from the Russian public, but anyway, that's obviously a massive event which is also being prepared. And last but not least, and not to be discounted, Putin must also prepare for his State of the Union address, which will probably be delivered sometime in January. So Putin has a very, very heavy schedule before him in December. But of course, the Americans are expecting to meet with Putin when they go to Moscow. And no doubt Putin will have to find the time in some way. But there will be scheduling difficulties, and this is something that does need to be taken into account also. Anyway, the Americans are going to Moscow. Driscoll tried, it seems, to start some kind of dialogue with the Russians in Abu Dhabi, a perfectly appropriate thing, it seems to me, for Driscoll to want to do. But the Russians explained, probably in Abu Dhabi and through other channels, that this dialogue must be conducted at a much more senior level, and this is now being arranged. Now, I've read out Ushakov's words in full, because it's obvious that the Russians are furious about the Abu Dhabi meeting, and it's impossible to avoid the irony, the sarcasm in Ushakov's comments. Firstly, I think that Ushakov probably feels, at a personal level, somewhat aggrieved that Driscoll would want to contact intelligence officers in Abu Dhabi rather than approach him. He is, after all, Ushakov, after all, is Putin's national security advisor. But what I suspect really angers the Russians is not Driscoll's meeting with the Russians in Abu Dhabi, which I personally think was an appropriate thing to do, but the fact that this meeting with the Russians in Abu Dhabi was leaked to the American media. And I have to say, I do wonder by whom. Of course, it could have been Driscoll, but there is now a very serious possibility that it could be someone else. And I say this because over the last couple of days, there has been a leaking campaign going on in Washington, which is clearly intended to derail the entire negotiation process. So, firstly, a transcript of what purports to be a telephone conversation between Dmitriev and Ushakov has been leaked, one in which Dmitriev appears to confirm that it was he who leaked to Axios and the Financial Times the original version of the Trump plan. Now, Dmitriev is saying that this leak is a fake, and I suspect he is right. My own view, and I still hold to it, is that the leaker of the plan, the original version of the plan, was probably Kellogg, though of course I don't know this for a fact. Much more serious than that leak is a purported leak of a conversation between Ushakov and Witkoff. And here is how TASS reports Ushakov's reactions to this leak. The goal of leaking the transcripts of Ushakov's alleged conversations with Witkoff is to hinder efforts to strengthen Russia-US relations. And Ushakov is quoted as saying, "It's probably to hinder the process. This is hardly been done to improve relations." It is not clear where the media obtained information on phone calls between Moscow and Washington. Some are taping, some are leaking, but it is not us. Phone calls with Witkoff happen often, but Russia never discloses confidential conversations to the media. I don't comment on the essence of the conversations as they are confidential. No one should comment on such things. Now, it's been taken by some sections of the media in the West. These words of Ushakov's are being taken as saying that Ushakov is effectively acknowledging that these transcripts of the Witkoff Ushakov conversations are real. That is not what Ushakov is doing. Ushakov says that he often holds conversations with Witkoff. He is furious that somebody is both taping these calls and leaking them, because these are supposed to be confidential calls. And he's not going to comment one way or the other about whether the content of these conversations is true. Dmitriev, by the way, has also said that the contents of the leaks, the transcripts, are untrue. Now, I am not going to discuss myself whether the contents of these leaks are true or not. I was not party to these calls. Perhaps they are true. The more interesting conversation is the one between Ushakov and Witkoff. This took place before the telephone call between Putin and Trump, over the course of which Trump proposed to Putin the summit meeting between himself and Putin in Budapest, which Trump then called off. Anyway, the point here is that over the course of this call, Ushakov and Witkoff are discussing the value of holding a call between Putin and Trump, and Witkoff is giving Ushakov a steer, saying that one of the things that Trump would be pleased to hear is praise from Putin of Trump's success in negotiating the ceasefire in Gaza. Now, I don't myself find anything wrong in this conversation at all. There's been claims that the contents of this conversation is inappropriate and misconceived. I can't see in what way. I don't see why Witkoff and Ushakov, who clearly want to get the process of dialogue between their two countries moving forward, should not, over the course of a conversation of this kind, discuss such things. But all right, I understand that some people take a different view. What is much more concerning, however, is that these calls are being taped by someone and leaked by someone, and that these leaks are clearly being used to undermine the whole process, to create the impression that the Russians are leading this negotiation process, that it is they who are being, who are in effect in the driving seat, and that they're leading people like Witkoff along, and that Witkoff is again in some way complicit to this process. Now, it's important to stress that what we're getting here are brief excerpts of conversations. If these conversations, even if these excerpts are even true. Now let's assume that they are true. These were conversations that the authorized representative of the President of the United States was conducting with senior officials of a foreign government, the Russian government, intended to promote diplomacy between the United States and Russia. I would have thought, in fact, I am absolutely sure, that these therefore are classified conversations. I can understand why somebody in Washington would be recording these conversations. I'm sure the United States often records conversations with senior Russian officials, though I would point out that when President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine long ago had a telephone conversation, a conversation which gave rise to impeachment proceedings against President Trump back in 2019, just say. Well, anyway, that call, apparently no recording was made of it, or so we were told at the time. But the point is that if there were recordings, the recordings must be classified. If they were made because someone in the US intelligence community was conducting surveillance on Yuri Ushakov, which would be understandable, then the conversation is clearly classified because it is part of intelligence gathering. If it is a diplomatic call between, as I said, a US official, Witkoff, who is, as I said, the authorized president of the representative of the President of the United States, and as I said, a foreign government, then again, I assume it is classified. In either case, it is surely illegal, probably, I'm guessing, a criminal offence to leak it. And yet, someone is now doing precisely that. And I have to guess, this is my best guess, that it is that same person, or perhaps more accurately, group of people who have now leaked the telephone meetings, the details of the meetings between the Russian intelligence officers and Driscoll, which took place in Abu Dhabi. Now, by doing that, they not only disclosed the fact that this meeting happened, but they have also outed Kirill Budanov, Ukraine's military intelligence chief, as somebody who has been conducting secret talks with the Russians. Now, that might have grave consequences for Budanov himself. Firstly, I don't know whether Budanov has had authority from Zelensky to conduct private conversations with the Russians of this kind. Perhaps he has, but it would not be completely inconceivable if Budanov was acting by himself. I don't believe, I should say, that he is acting by himself, but for some time now, Budanov has been going off script in Kiev. He said earlier in the year that unless there was a ceasefire by mid-summer, the situation for Ukraine would start to go downhill fast. He was absolutely right about that, but there was fury in Kiev about this, and there has been, and it is well known that there has been, a campaign by Zelensky's all-powerful chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, to get Budanov sacked. And Budanov, since then, has made other comments which also seem to go off script and has been saying things about the direction of the war, which essentially admit and acknowledge that the war is lost. Now, it's not impossible, in fact, I would say it's highly likely, that Budanov has at least in some part formed this view as a result of these conversations, these secret conversations he's been having with the Russians. Now, everyone in Ukraine now knows that these conversations in Abu Dhabi have been taking place. Everybody knows that Budanov has been participating in them. There are some people in Ukraine who are going to be furious about this. Some people like Yermak might use this fact in a renewed attempt to get Budanov sacked. But there is also always the possibility in Ukraine that Budanov, who has survived more than one assassination attempt, could now become the target of others. And that will have been, at least in part, possibly the product of the disclosure that he is involved in private meetings with the Russians. The Russians did not want the fact of these meetings to be made public, and I cannot imagine that Budanov wanted the fact of the meeting to be made public either. Budanov was probably perfectly content that Driscoll should meet with the Russians, but the Russians, Budanov, and I assume Driscoll, never intended that this meeting should be in Abu Dhabi should be made public. And it all looks to me, again, as part of this leaking campaign that is taking place in Washington. Now, that tells us something important. The fact that somebody is leaking, and as I said, even if I'm wrong about what I'm saying about the leaking or the supplying of information about the Driscoll meeting in Abu Dhabi is wrong, some of these leaks, to me at least, look like illegal acts, perhaps even criminal acts. I'm not an expert on this matter. I'm not an expert on classification procedures in the United States. But anyway, that is how it looks to me. And that tells me that there are powerful people in the American government, people who have access to recordings of conversations between top American officials and their counterparts. Doesn't matter whether these recordings are real or not real. The fact that they're able to claim that they are real shows that they are the sort of people who the media would expect to have access to these recordings. Anyway, people with that kind of access, that kind of information, who are now engaging in a leaking operation in order to throw into confusion, to stop this entire negotiation process. And that tells me both the recklessness and ruthlessness and sense of impunity that these people have. It reminds me, I have to say, of much of the massively damaging leaking that was done against President Trump and his officials in the first weeks of his administration, his first administration in 2017, where leaks were appearing all over the place, implying collusion between President Trump and the Russians. So that is now taking place again. And of course, all of this is happening even as congressional opponents of this entire process, people like McConnell, Senator Warner, all of these other people, Lindsey Graham, are now busy tweeting their wholehearted opposition to this entire process as well. We've also had further attempts to sabotage this process from President Macron of France. He continues to insist on France's right and the right of the coalition of the willing to deploy troops in Ukraine. He's talking quite openly about this. He made absolutely crazy comments. I mean, that's the only way I can describe them, about the Russians. He said that Russia no longer does anything in its social work. It doesn't open schools or hospitals or things of that kind. I'm paraphrasing what he said. I'm not quoting his exact words. He says all that they do now is churn out submarines and bombers and all those kind of things in order to fight us. That is so completely not the case that I have to say, when I read Macron's words, it left me speechless. But then by this point, I suppose, I should not be surprised. Anyway, that was Macron. He's, by the way, been heavily criticised again in France by some people for saying these things. Chancellor Merz of Germany is also busy. And of course, Keir Starmer is also busy as well, despite the fact that his government is about to present its budget, which will probably cause all kinds of further massive problems for him. So we could see that there is a concerted mobilization in Washington, in Europe, and in Ukraine to derail this entire process. And I have to say that whatever Driscoll, Wyckoff, and Kushner hope to achieve in Moscow, I can't help but think that the opposition is going to, in the end, prove insurmountable. I said earlier that I am sceptical about where Rubio, the Secretary of State, stands on this. There was an article that appeared, a report which appeared on NBC, which said that there is a split between Witkoff, Driscoll and Kushner on the one hand, who want to end the war and understand that the war is being lost, and who are trying to get some kind of peace initiative through and want to put pressure on Ukraine to accept it, a realistic plan to end the war, even if that means doing so on what will be basically Russian terms. And Rubio, who is resistant to all of this and who wants stronger sanctions against Russia instead. Now, in fairness, Rubio has categorically denied the truth of this report. He says that this report is pure fiction. He says that the administration is united. All I would say is that maybe he's telling the truth, but it is interesting that some people in the media think that it might make sense to play Rubio off against all of the others. Now, for the moment at least, some kind of positive momentum, if you like, exists. there's been this decision to send Witkoff and Kushner, and I presume Driscoll, to Moscow. And interestingly, Trump is refusing to meet Zelensky. Zelensky has been pressing for a meeting with Trump. He apparently wants the Europeans there. I think it has been a massive mistake, by the way, and Ushakov touched on that in the comments of his, which I read out a few moments ago. Ushakov asked, why aren't the Europeans even involved? And I agree with him. I don't understand myself why the Europeans constantly have to be involved, why the United States and Russia cannot come to agreements about Ukraine with each other, why they have to defer to the Europeans all the time, why they can't even come to an agreement with each other and inform the Ukrainians about this. Again, I truly don't understand any of that. But anyway, I'm not going to dwell on this. Anyway, Zelensky wanted to meet with Trump. He wanted to bring all the Europeans with him. He wanted, in other words, to rerun the whole August meeting when Zelensky met Trump and had all of the European leaders there. This time, thankfully, Trump appears to have recognized that meeting that he had with the Europeans in August was a mistake. And he is saying no. He is saying, at least publicly, that he wants to know that there's going to be an actual deal done before he meets anybody, Putin or Zelensky. And by the way, that is the correct decision for Donald Trump to make. So there continues to be some momentum in this process. But it's clear that the permanent government of the United States is adamantly opposed to it. The Europeans are adamantly opposed to it. The Ukrainians themselves have not come round to accepting it. Now, I come back to this, a point I've made many times, which is that I cannot fathom ultimately the reason why. Zelensky, the Europeans, the permanent government in the United States, the neocons in the media, presumably they continue to be closing their ears and their eyes to the realities of the situation on the ground. The fact that Ukraine is losing the war and is losing it badly. I mean, do they want Ukraine to lose? Do they want Ukraine to be destroyed? Or are they simply completely deluded? I read a bizarre article today by Ambrose Evans Pritchard in the Daily Telegraph. He used to be an interesting journalist, but he's become stranger and stranger as the war has proceeded. He talks about the Trump plan being snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Russia apparently is on the brink of collapse. Nobody's buying its oil. And Trump has probably only come round because Putin is bribing him with the share of the frozen assets. I mean, it seemed to me utterly ludicrous to read it. And as for nobody wanting to buy Russian oil, well, Xi Jinping has just written a congratulatory letter to the 7th China-Russia Energy Business Forum. He said that China-Russia energy cooperation began early with a solid foundation and has become a model of mutually beneficial cooperation between the two sides. It has played an active role in promoting the economic and social development of both countries and improving the well-being of their peoples. China is ready to work with Russia to continuously strengthen their comprehensive energy cooperation partnership jointly safeguard the stability and smooth flow of the global energy, industrial and supply chains and help build a fairer and more just, balanced and inclusive global energy governance system, injecting greater stability to global energy security and the green and low carbon transition. Now, that was written by Xi Jinping yesterday. Does that sound like the letter? A letter from the leader of a government of a country that's going to stop importing Russian oil? It's worth pointing out that China is the biggest buyer of Russian oil. India, of course, is also a big buyer of Russian oil. And Putin is just about to visit India. Again, all of this about the world turning its back on Russia is delusional. What is being said about the Russian economy is delusional. Ambrose Evans Pritchard said that leaks had confirmed that the Russians had lost 100,000 men over the course of the Battle of Pokrovsk. Which leaks? I've seen none. I have seen no leaks from any Russian source making any such fantastic claim. But anyway, that's the comforting illusions in which all of these people appear to be, to find themselves in. I mean, as I said, it all seems most bizarre to me, but there it is. Now, this has left me very little time to discuss the military situation, even though, as I said at the start of the programme, the military situation is what is driving the situation in the political and diplomatic sphere. Firstly, there is no doubt now that the Russians are pushing through Gallipoli. The town is indeed being stormed. The Russian Defense Ministry over the last 2 days has started to publish a whole series of statements about the situation in Pokrovsk, which strongly suggests that they now are preparing for an announcement that Pokrovsk itself has been fully captured. I appreciate that there is a narrative which has, in my opinion, unquestionably a Ukrainian source. A narrative is out there that the Ukrainians have conducted successful counterattacks in the northeastern parts of Pokrovsk. Again, no video footage that I've seen to support any of these claims. And Radovka, which I consider to be the most reliable source of information about the Battle of Pokrovsk, Radovka published yesterday a long account of the situation, and they said that far from there being successful Ukrainian counterattacks in the Pokrovsk area, on the contrary, the Ukrainian High Command has finally accepted that the battle for Pokrovsk and the battle to unblock the Ukrainian forces trapped in Mirnograd has been lost, and they are transferring troops away from the Pokrovsk area to other areas where the Russians are achieving breakthroughs on the front lines. And I believe that is true, and the Russian Defense Ministry now has officially confirmed that there is a leafleting campaign amongst Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd to try to get them to surrender, which again suggests to me that the battle there is now coming to an end. There is a lot more that can be said about the military situation. I'm not going to discuss it in this programme because, well, this has been a long programme already looking at the chaotic diplomatic and political process. But to reiterate again, it is the military situation which is driving the diplomacy. I would finish with one final comment. However we want to spin it, this diplomacy is chaotic. The Trump administration continues to run, to conduct diplomacy in an extraordinarily eccentric way. We would not have all of these strange events, these leaks, these strange leaks, these bizarre meetings, or these odd meetings in Abu Dhabi and things of that kind, if we instead had proper negotiations with proper negotiating teams, meeting in plenaries on a regular basis, as used to happen between the American and Russian sides during the Cold War. Nor would we have the confusion about the multiples of different peace plans that are now in circulation. Ushakov, by the way, has also complained about that. He says that there's any number of versions of this peace plan floating around now, and the Russians are becoming bewildered by the number, as, by the way, am I. But we must, I suppose, deal with what exists. The Trump administration doesn't want to conduct diplomacy in the conventional way. Probably the president himself simply doesn't understand that kind of diplomacy. And I suspect that the knowledge of how to conduct it in the State Department and in the other agencies of the American government no longer exists. And of course, there's the problem that the permanent government of the United States appears to be hostile to any negotiations at all. So we have this chaotic, confused mess, multiple plans, multiple leaks. Witkoff and Kushner and Driscoll going off to Moscow with who knows what plan, the Americans meeting with the Europeans and the Ukrainians, who then, of course, try to impose their ideas, when, properly speaking, they shouldn't be involved at this stage at all. Anyway, all of this going on, maybe it will eventually result in some kind of positive outcome. I still have my doubts, but there it is. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also, of course, our new Substack site. Please also remember that you can you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please also remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if you want to support this program, these programs. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.